step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made it.
Did you ever play the video game Kaboom?
I'd have to rack my brain. It must be really old, is it?
It is. It's really, really old game with, you know, like graphics that show that it's really old. But basically, it's a mad bomber throwing things down and kaboom.
Ah, right. Like a Donkey Kong type thing.
Exactly. I used to play it all the time and it never really registered to me how violent that thing was. But then again, I guess almost every video game had that kind of component to it.
Yeah.
I mean, even Pac-Man was cannibalistic.
Oh, absolutely.
So welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host, Paige Schechter, and with me today is Kurt North, hashtag Maranortha. Hello.
Ooh,
Kurt.
Like, hello, how are you doing? You okay?
Good. You like your hashtag?
I do. That's fantastic. I love it.
Okay. Before we dial up 522-6666, we should bring you into the fold with the five group initiation questions.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. When did you first discover Millennium?
Well, luckily for me, I wanted to see it straight away. So it was off the back of the X-Files. I heard that Chris Carter was doing a new show, and I was there for the pilot, the very first episode.
I'm sure I know the answer to this question, but what is your favourite episode?
No, he may not actually. That my favourite episode is The Curse of Frank Black.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. And to be absolutely honest, it's one of my favourite, it was my favourite episode of all time on any TV show for a long time. It's only been taken over by part 8 of Twin Peaks season 3. It's just that unique an episode that I just find it amazing. I just love the Curse of Frank Black.
It really is a great episode, and we'll be getting into some of that kind of feel in a little bit. So, what is your favorite season?
Favorite season would definitely be season 2. About season 2, a lot of people say that the serial killer of the week of season 1. It weakens the season. I actually think love season 1. I do really love it. I love the darkness of it. But season 2 overall as a piece is just an amazing 20-odd episodes of a season. I love everything within it. It's got, as I say, The Curse of Frank Black in it. It's got the obviously some Darren Morgan stuff in there as well. So the whole season 2, is absolutely fantastic as far as I'm concerned. It's hard to beat in any season on any TV show.
And Midnight of the Century, and so many good ones.
Midnight of the Century, again, it's that's a companion. I love that as a companion piece to Curse of Frank Black. Midnight of the Century is one of my favorite episodes too. I just love that. I love the feelings that's within that about his dad and everything regarding that kind of myth side of Millennium as such. I just love that.
Well, this is my second Millennium podcast, and I also did Dead Letters. And at the time, I was towing what used to be my old company line, and it used to be season 1, because I really took to the original concept of how Chris Carter had drawn it up. But when you do rewatches, season 2, you know, raises the bar.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's become season 2 for me with all these landmark episodes and with Glenn Morgan and James Wong at the helm. It got more dense, but there's also so much more to dig into and sort of ruminate on and sort of stays with you than season 1. So I'm changing my vote to season 2.
What's that in a few weeks, or is that over the course of quite some time?
I've been doing a lot of rewatches, and that's when you really see, as great as season one is, there is something more to season two. And, you know, for years, since the original airing of Millennium, I always said season one, but in retrospect and in watching these all again, it's like season two really has it going on.
Yeah.
Sidetrack, where do you stand on season three? Do you like that one?
Season three, it's really ropey. I went through a rewatch of Millennium about, I'd say maybe 6 to 8 months ago, and it was a hard slog getting through season three. It's not my favourite season. I struggled to get through a lot of it. But then there was episodes, the snow episode is incredible. And when they start dealing with the aftermath of what happens at the end of season two, there's a few episodes in there that are really, really good. It's just let down by that first part of the season. I don't know if it's like the first eight, first nine episodes, like of Human Essence and episodes like that, which just didn't resonate for me whatsoever. But as I say, that I can't remember what that snow episode was called now, but that one is up there. I think that's one of the best episodes of the show's run. So it has its moments, but overall, it's not my favourite.
Right. I'm sort of feeling like season three is becoming like season nine of the X-Files for me. I'm like a defender of it because I really like Clea Scott, and it, you know, it takes a while to work her properly into the canvas. But yeah, once they do, and she's got more going for her than just being, you know, a partner to Frank Black and a female partner. And there are motivations and things that make it stronger for me.
I wouldn't say it's a season nine of the X-Files as such. I think there's more in season three of Millennium than there is in season nine of the X-Files. I just think that the slog of getting to the good episodes is quite slog, and that kiss episode is just the worst episode ever seen in my life. So, but yeah, so I am a defender of season three to a degree, but it is a hard season to watch.
Okay. And who is your favorite character on Millennium?
I would probably say, especially growing up, Lucy Butler. I think Lucy Butler was a fantastic, brilliant character to have been made up. She has some fantastic scenes with Frank Black. And I do think, she comes up in various different guises, and it could have probably been done better in some ways. But every time she came up, it made me jump up out of my seat and go, right, I'm really looking forward to this now. There's some interesting scenes later on in the run in season, I think it was season three. And The Room in Your View is one of my favourite episodes too. So yeah, Lucy is definitely my favourite.
Yeah, Sarah Jane Redmond, really, she rocks it.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And what is your favourite moment from the show?
Can a moment be 20 minutes long?
Yes, it can be 20 minutes long.
Well, I probably wouldn't go that far. I would say Lara Mean's descending into madness during The Time Is Now. It's just the most Lynchian thing I've seen that's got close from a 10-13 production. It's definitely the closest thing to a Lynch thing that I've ever seen from that group. I would add to tack on the last few minutes of The Time Is Now as well. I just think that both of those pieces, the descent of the personal apocalypse and the actual apocalypse, is absolutely outstanding. Just love those two bits, and together, as I say, is 20 minutes long. If I had to choose one or the other, I'd probably go with the Lara Means scene. I just think that's just something else. It's mind-boggling. The cacophony of stuff that's happening within that episode all together is just amazing. I can't speak highly enough of that scene.
It's amazing that was on television, you know. I remember just watching it, and especially on rewatch, you know, you see how wonderful Kristen Cloke is in the scene, but you're just mystified. This is something that's on television and not in a movie. Let's get into 522-666. How many sixes did I do? It's the fifth episode of the inaugural season and first aired on November 22nd, 1996. Just in time for Thanksgiving. I looked up at the calendar, though, and where Millennium aired was actually, it was the episode before Thanksgiving, but there were like 6 days till Thanksgiving. So it's not like Thanksgiving, next day, you know, craziness of Millennium. There was sort of a break in there. So it's right. Not as bad as it may sound. So it is in a three-way tie for the fourth highest ratings of the season, and thus the series at 7.6.
Okay.
It has a 7.7 ranking at IMDb, which is kind of middle of the pack for the season, but it's one of my favorites of the first year. So where do you stand on it, Kurt?
It is one of my favorites of the first year. I love the episodes towards the back end, things like Force Majeure and episodes like that. I do like the early run as well. I do like some of the stuff that comes before it. But I think that the reason why I'm going to call it Kaboom, so I don't get the numbers wrong, the reason why Kaboom, for me, works quite well as in the whole season is that it's the first real one where we have to, it's more of a procedural, it's quite, could easily quite fit into another TV show in some degrees, because you've got the likes of the Frenchman in the pilot, you've got some of the Legion stuff happening in Gehenna and the Judge, and Dead Letters, which I know you've done recently, is kind of like a mirror to what Frank Black is and where he is in his life compared to the other Millennium candidate. And 522666 comes at a point where it needed a little bit of, I would say a freshen up, but needed a slight different tact on the serial killer of the week, which Millennium gets stuck with quite a lot. So I do like where it fits into the season. And as a general thriller episode, I think it really works. You could easily see it being rewritten and made for a film, really, as well. So I really like it from that point of view, and I do think that the analog of kind of like a Frank Black with a Moriarty really works well. And some of the things that we'll probably get into during the episode is quite an interesting take on how the world was during that time.
I think that's a great analogy to Moriarty, because the character is so much like that.
Yeah, he is. I just love the games that they're playing between themselves, and you know, Moriarty's obviously looking for an equal to Sherlock Holmes, and it's just a nice little play on the way that is. I know he has different motives than that, but it certainly has that feel to it.
Right. Okay, so this, of course, Kaboom, we'll call it, was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong, well known, of course, in the X-Files universe as scripters who not only got the sister show on the path to greatness with the episode Squeeze, but consistently churned out fan favorites for as long as they were part of the show's writing team. And they go on to take the reins of Millennium in the second season, as we mentioned already, and give it much more of a mythology bent while creating some of the most resonant standalones, as we mentioned. But here, they're really towing the line that creator, executive producer Chris Carter laid out for the first season, and they're serving that structure to the utmost of their abilities, but they're still kind of doing it in their own inimitable fashion. And what's really striking is you can see the division of the kind of stories told on the X-Files here within the course of this one episode.
Yeah, you can. And I think that the way that Morgan and Wong were toeing the line probably suits the early part of Millennium, because they are finding the feet and finding out where it can go and what it can do. And as you say, once they get into season 2, it's a different matter. But here it's very much kind of reined in and just a tight 45 minutes of television.
It's really a lot more straightforward than the four previous episodes had been. You know, we're seeing how Frank goes about answering the tough questions. Why does someone do it? And how can he be stopped? And it's a lot like people really like it when Mulder on the X-Files got to show his skill as a profiler. And here we're seeing that in Frank Black.
Yeah.
So our bad guy, Raymond Deese, the mad bomber, he, this is my big line for this, he feeds off the pain of his victims rather than just feeding off his victims. That's the difference between Millennium and the X-Files.
Okay, I wouldn't have never come up with a line like that, so well done to that.
And his thirst to continue doing what he's doing escalates because he's not getting the high he wants off of him. So first he just watches, and then he helps victims after the fact, and then he kind of teases the feds and becomes within sort of a hair's breadth of getting caught, and ultimately he creates an inferno that he's in the middle of.
Yeah, it's a good analogy that. I also think that it's interesting how the play on him wanting to be a star kind of comes up now, whether or not that was his first intention, because obviously he bombs the first pub, but whether or not that was his intention to begin with, that he wanted to be known, but that just wasn't happening, and that frustration and that element of needing more and more because it sort of excited him becomes evanescent and kind of explodes into what it becomes towards the end of the show.
First, I want to mention this fabulous guest performance by Joe Crest as Deez. He's become very well known since then as Ted Wheeler in Stranger Things. This is the perfect, he hits just the right note in this performance.
You know, he plays it down really, really well. You can imagine him being that person next door to you, and you can imagine him being quite a quiet person, and you don't really understand who he is and what he is. So I really do think that he underplays that so well, and it's a testament to his acting skills, because it could have easily become quite a larger than life character and could have been quite cheesy and quite what's the best word to put it? Quite cheesy, but quite also just full blown and cartoonish, and it didn't do that.
And over the top and that sort of thing. One of the through lines, as you mentioned, is sort of his fascination with the media and the media's fascination with him, and how he needs that so much. You know, he's in, before we go to the opening montage, he's on the scene and he's helping victims, and he just wants his face on television, and social media is not even a glint in anyone's eye when this originally aired.
Yeah.
But the fascination of people with what's on TV and getting on TV really is a huge part of this episode.
Yeah, it is. You think about when this show aired, did you say it was 1996?
Yes.
This came, so 1996, so MTV's Real World came out in 1992. That was kind of the kind of first reality TV show that we had. And then we became fascinated with 24 hours, 7 days a week news coverage. The O.J. Simpson chase was obviously a big thing, and people started latching onto those types of events, and people were becoming more and more enamoured with fandom and stardom, and wanting to be on telly, wanting to be having your 15 minutes of fame.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's not unique to the time, because obviously some of the stuff that this was based on, the Mad Bombers and the security guard Richard Jewell, which was, I think that was probably after what happened here. But some of the stuff like the Mad Bombers, where they were sending newspaper clippings to the police and things, is it taunting them? I think it's kind of human nature, but it's a new medium. It's an early medium in TV where reality shows were really kicking in at this point. And I think it's a good look on that. And I think that's what probably what the episode is trying to do, is trying to give an opinion on reality TV at that stage where, you know, people just want their 10 minutes, 15 minutes of fame.
Right. One of the other things that you just mentioned, of things that raised the public consciousness on that, was like watching the Gulf War on TV.
Yeah.
And seeing these bombings, you know, happen. I remember very vividly watching that on CNN, you know, in the early hours of the morning, and just terrifying. So the subject matter of the bombings of British pubs and everything, is this something that you recall from when you were a kid, with the fear about that?
The Arndale shopping bombing was in Manchester. Manchester's about an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes away from where I am. So, and the IRA was obviously a big thing as I was growing up. And the things like the phoning in bomb threats, or phoning in saying that there's a bomb in a particular building. I remember being working at the Social Security. This was back in 1999, 2000, I would have thought. And there was routine things that were passed on to you because it was a government building. Now, what effectively happens with the IRA, generally, I'm just saying in general terms because a lot of different things happen, but generally, if they sent a coded message, that was all designed. And there was an actual book that you could go through to find out what that meant. So they had all these coded messages that effectively said there was a bomb in that building, that they were looking to destroy or damage that building, but not obviously civilians and people. So the coded messages were designed to make people evacuate, and then obviously then to blow up parts of the building. And the secondary thing sometimes was that there was send that coded message in and then have a secondary bomb, which was aimed at maiming soldiers and maiming police and things. So it to a degree earlier when it was rife, it was in my mindset earlier on, but not so much that, because I was very young when the majority of that happened, but especially in my later life, when I was working for the Social Security, there was a lot of, yearly training sessions that we had on what to do if you ever received a bomb threat and things like that. So it certainly was part of my growing up.
So when you saw this particular episode, how did that fit into how you felt personally?
I think that I'm seeing the episode, and it probably linked in quite well in some ways, because it was something that was fascinating. And this was before I started working the social, so it was obviously based on children's experiences. And it was almost like not an everyday occurrence, but this happened in the world. This wasn't something that is new or fantastic to me. This was something that happened. And I think watching the episode at the time would have been more of a, well, this could possibly happen. This is something that could happen, and it does happen in the world today.
And as you mentioned, there was the domestic terrorist pipe bombing at Centennial Park during the Summer Olympics in Atlanta. And
yeah,
that's when we in America, you know, really, that really hit home for us. But it was like the movies like In the Name of the Father and all those kind of movies that showed these kind of things that really made it resonate more, you know. Watching it on the news, we didn't get it quite as well as we did through, you know, films and TV like Lenny. Well, first of all, I don't know how they did this on a television show. I guess it helped to have David Nutter doing the directing, because he's another X-Files legend with like Ice and Beyond the Sea, Irresistible, Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. But it really recalled to me those movies when I saw this particular episode. And In the Name of the Father is one that has always stuck with me. I think I think it's a great movie, and it's hard to say it's underrated because it got a lot of Oscar nominations, but it also came out the same year as Schindler's List, so it didn't win any kind of thing. But that's a personal favorite movie, and this is a personal favorite episode.
Yeah, and at the time as well, I'm not sure where this falls in. It probably would be around 96, I would have thought. Likes of Speed came out, and who was obviously Dennis Hopper was playing a character who was felt he didn't get his retirement fund and use his knowledge of bomb making to do what happened in Speed. So there is a a kind of move towards doing these kind of shows and films around the mid-90s, really.
So this particular story is taking place in Washington, D.C., and it kind of moved us away from the Yellow House and Seattle for a bit. Did you think that was kind of a necessary, quote-unquote, evil?
The way that they included Catherine on the phone was probably the way that they wanted to go with it. I suppose Washington, D.C. is as big as that is, they kind of wanted that large-scale feel. I think that's probably the way they were going.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up this, how Catherine gets worked into the mix, because even though he's already all the way across the country, we're getting, in some ways, a better look at that relationship and the progression of it than we might have if it happened in Seattle. And she listens in to the whole phone call between Frank and Dee's. I think there's this big difference for her between knowing Frank's good at his job and actually hearing him be good at it.
Yeah, I felt that in the episode when I've watched it. I definitely felt that she was part of the audience at that point. It was appearing to what his actual world was. Yeah, I definitely feel that you're right there. It gave Catherine something else to think about. The only thing that I, over the five or six episodes that we were at this point, that I felt was a bit jarring was that the home life didn't feel as, it felt a bit a struggle because of what happened to Frank before the millennium did start, and you don't really get an idea of how the relationship was before, and it already feels not strained, but there's just not something quite right. They've gone through something, some sort of trauma. Mm-hmm. And this is only repeating this for her, the fact that she's hearing how deep, how dark that he can get by listening to that conversation.
Well, I have some little things to add to the mix here, but do you have any other big points about this particular episode that you think we should get into?
As I say, looking at the reality side of things was kind of my big thing that I noticed from the episode, but I do think that it's a tight thriller. Mark Snow's music obviously is very reminiscent of likes of 1971 and X-Files, and the helicopter scenes, which would be done by a drone now, are fantastic. I love those little flyby scenes that they do, and the moment where they are, some of the direction that David Nutter does is the scene where they're talking about the plan and the camera's going both inside and outside of the circle that they've created, and I thought that was a brilliant piece of direction. I thought that was a wonderful piece of direction, and it's one of the scenes, bizarrely, that stuck with me going through years later, whenever I thought back to Millennium, that stuck with me. It was one of those scenes that just stuck in my head as soon as I thought about it. So I just thought it was a fantastic piece of direction.
Like you just said, this is the one that stuck with me over the years, you know, because I went a few years before watching Millennium again, before the box set came out and whatnot. And this is the one that I always thought back to. It just struck me so strongly.
The whole concept, as I say, going back to the reality thing, the whole concept of him, of Dee's basically manipulating everyone, including his death, really works quite well. And I think that the end scene with the two cars, I think that scene is particularly a nice, tight, stress-inducing scene. And yeah, I think it's just wonderfully played.
Yes. Did you notice when Frank gets into the car, there's this little point of light in the distance where Dee's is? And I get so tense at that moment, even before, you know, Raymond calls him up and turns on the high beams, because you know he's there. It's like, it is so creepy. And like you said, the way he controls his demise, I think it definitely gives us a taste of what's going to come in season two from these two, Morgan and Wong.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. And I'm so happy that this episode, because I had a feeling that some people didn't particularly like this one, but from things I've seen, people do actually think it's a good episode. And I would liken it to what they do in season two as well, to the Mikado. I think it's a similar, although it's different, it's a similar feel to a similar type of episode that they do with Mikado in the second season.
Oh, what a great episode that is.
Oh, I love that episode. I think it's fantastic.
The only note that bothers me is when the reporter is interviewing Deez on camera and says, how does it feel to be a star? I don't think we need to be hit over the head with that. I mean, Frank knows it's him. You know, what she meant is hero. How does it feel to be a hero? You know, star, it's just too on the nose for me. And I get a little cringy at that.
That's right. It does feel a bit strange, that, and a bit, as you say, a bit on the nose. But I do like when Frank gets up behind the bed with Catherine in front, and he basically says kaboom, and he's realised who that is. And the scenes before that, when, you know, Frank is brought into the building by Deez, that the fact that he's being saved by Deez, and that the whole interplay, the whole game is afoot, effectively, that, you know, Deez is wanting him to get involved, and the bomb goes off before the time, and he phones Frank Black up and says, now go to the third floor, and he has to go up to the third floor, and just that interplay and that gamesmanship that's happening within the two characters works really well.
Yeah, again, it's very reminiscent of Moriarty, because quite often he does get the leg up on Sherlock, even though Sherlock is so smart, you know, he still makes him do what he wants him to do, and ultimately he controlled how he died.
As you say, the whole fact that Deez has controlled everything pretty much from minute one to the end is a testament to the show, really, because it could have easily have gone another way. It could have easily have been written in a way that Frank becomes the hero at the end, but it has a kind of a downbeat, thoughtful, meaningful ending, really, rather than being just a, you know, hurrah, we've got the bomber sort of thing. So I really like that.
Oh no, he's being dark. Very millennialistic.
Yes, that's what I love about it, though. I love darkness, and
that,
I love that.
You know what? That is what the show is, and so I can see it. I can see it turning off people, but it never did that to me. It felt, this is exactly the way it's supposed to go, you know, and it's not supposed to end on a happy note.
No.
It's supposed to be dark.
It is supposed to be dark, and that's why I love season one so much, and that's what kept me kept me going through the season. I know it gets that serial killer of the week vibe, but I do actually like that. And I like, what I also like, just coming off the episode for a bit, is the kind of the Legion myth arc to a degree as well. I think they could have done something with that within season one. They kind of messed with that a little bit and worked, see what they could do with Gehenna and the judge and things. And I thought that would have been a really interesting way to go. Had Chris Carter continued in season two, it would have been a completely different show. Probably more of the likes of Hannibal than what we got in season two. But season two, as you say, is just outstanding.
Yeah, it's hard to complain with season two. And yet, I'd still like to see Chris Carter's version of season two, because I like, you know, the character of Frank Black is so strong that you kind of want to see him in every single possible variation. You know, I want to see him do this. I'd like to see him do more procedurals. I'd like to see the Morgan and Wong vision of season two. I'd like a Hannibalistic version of season two. I would totally be down for that.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic.
So just a couple notes I have mentioning Sam Anderson, the veteran character actor who plays Agent Jack Pearson. He was actually on Millennium before he was on The X-Files in Pine Bluff variant. I find that kind of amusing.
And he was Bernard in Lost as well.
Yes, of course. And I saw two little Easter eggs during my latest rewatch of this episode. There's that line when Frank is watching the television before he sees footage of the first bombing, and the announcer says, "One of the best news shows of the season after football." And I'm like, this is, he's describing how Millennium was presented.
Right, yeah. That's a little meta there. I love a bit of meta. That's great. I didn't catch that. I'll have to go back to that.
And the other one was Frank's doctor. Did you notice the name of Frank's doctor?
No.
Dr. Bowman.
Oh, right, okay.
In tribute to Rob Bowman, the legendary X-Files director and producer. Excellent. Okay, so where can we find you on the World Wide Web?
You can find me online at R. Muldrake, at R. Muldrake.
I can often be found at sibling_cinema on Twitter. And my sister and I do like 10-word movie reviews, X-Files rewatch, and we're also on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, Pinterest, and of course in the new podcast fan group on Facebook. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you.
And remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.